The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul by Douglas Adams, read by Stephen Mangan. Chapter 1. It can hardly be a coincidence that no language on earth has ever produced the expression, as pretty as an airport. Airports are ugly. Some are very ugly. Some attain a degree of ugliness that can only be the result of a special effort. This ugliness arises because airports are full of people who are tired, cross, and have just discovered that their luggage has landed in Murmansk. Murmansk Airport is the only known exception to this otherwise infallible rule, and architects have, on the whole, tried to reflect this in their designs. They have sought to highlight the tiredness and crossness motif with brutal shapes and nerve-jangling colours, to make effortless the business of separating the traveller forever from his or her luggage or loved ones, to confuse the traveller with arrows that appear to point at the windows, distant tie racks, or the current position of Ursa Minor in the night sky, and wherever possible to expose the plumbing on the grounds that it is functional and conceal the location of the departure gates, presumably on the grounds that they are not. Caught in the middle of a sea of hazy light and a sea of hazy noise, Kate Schechter stood and doubted. All the way out of London to Heathrow, she had suffered from doubt. She was not a superstitious person or even a religious person. She was simply someone who was not at all sure she should be flying to Norway. But she was finding it increasingly easy to believe that God, if there was a God, and if it was remotely possible that any godlike being who could order the disposition of particles at the creation of the universe would also be interested in directing traffic on the M4, did not want her to fly to Norway either. All the trouble with the tickets, finding a next-door neighbour to look after the cat, then finding the cat so it could be looked after by the next-door neighbour, the sudden leak in the roof, the missing wallet, the weather, the unexpected death of the next-door neighbour, the pregnancy of the cat, it all had the semblance of an orchestrated campaign of obstruction which had begun to assume godlike proportions. Even the taxi driver, when she had eventually found a taxi, had said, "Norway? What do you want to go there for?" And when she hadn't instantly said, "The Aurora Borealis," or "Fjords," but had looked doubtful for a moment and bitten her lip, he had said, "I know, I bet it's some bloke dragging you out there. Tell you what, tell him to go stuff it, go to Tenerife." There was an idea. Tenerife. Or even, she dared to think for a fleeting second, home. She had stared dumbly out of the taxi window at the angry tangles of traffic and thought that however cold and miserable the weather was here, that was nothing to what it would be like in Norway. Or indeed at home. Home would be about as icebound as Norway right now. Icebound and punctuated with geysers of steam bursting out of the ground, catching in the frigid air and dissipating between the glacial cliff faces of Sixth Avenue. A quick glance at the itinerary Kate had pursued in the course of her 30 years would reveal her without any doubt to be a New Yorker. For though she had lived in the city very little, most of her life had been spent at a constant distance from it. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Europe, and a period of distracted wandering around South America 5 years ago, following the loss of her newly married husband, Luke, in a New York taxi-hailing accident. She enjoyed the notion that New York was home, and that she missed it, but in fact the only thing she really missed was pizza. And not just any old pizza, but the sort of pizza they brought to your door if you phoned them up and asked them to. That was the only real pizza. Pizza that you had to go out and sit at a table staring at red paper napkins for wasn't real pizza, however much extra pepperoni and anchovy they put on it. London was the place she liked living in most, apart, of course, from the pizza problem, which drove her crazy. Why would no one deliver pizza? Why did no one understand that it was fundamental to the whole nature of pizza that it arrived at your front door in a hot cardboard box, that you slithered it out of greaseproof paper and ate it in folded slices in front of the TV? What was the fundamental flaw in the stupid, stuck-up, sluggardly English that they couldn't grasp this simple principle? For some odd reason, it was the one frustration she could never learn simply to live with and accept, and about once a month or so